So what a week. What a week. The full on display of the toxins and the poisons of greed and hatred and ignorance. And often when I talk about these three toxins, I use the word ill will instead of hatred because I have sort of a very primal resistance to even using the word hatred. And when our kids were young and they would say something like, ew, I hate, whatever, it was our typical response. Hate is a very strong word. Is it that strong? Can you find another word? Which might have been our way of, not wanting to really deal with hate if that's what was coming up. But I've had to look at that this week because I think it is hatred. I think it is what we're seeing, and I can't sugarcoat my own heart, my own mind, my own wish for it to be ill will. I think it's much stronger than ill will, and of course it's ill will, but this is so big, it's so toxic. The Buddha said, there's no fire like lust, no grasping like hate, no snare like delusion, no river like craving. It's true. These are such powerful fetters. They are such powerful toxins, poisons, however you want to describe it. And there's no doubt. All we have to do is just look at this turmoil and the amount of pain and destruction and death that has occurred because of the ignorance. This is where it comes from, the delusion, the ignorance of those who are operating, in my view, in a reality that is not one that I share, that I think has led to all of this pain. So it's helpful to come back to these teachings. Another one from the Buddha that is very important from the Dhammapada. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of an ox. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. Can we take that in? So often we can hear these teachings and we can say, oh yeah, that sounds good. That sounds good. Well, it does sound good, but it's also profoundly important. Can we really take in that what we think, what we say, and what we do matters? It really matters. Notice how thoughts condition our speech. How speech informs our actions, and how actions always, always have consequences. And this is not to say that it's all negative, right? It's not all negative at all. But we've seen on display a negative, the truly painful, destructive power of greed, of hatred, of delusion, of when it takes hold of the mind and how that expresses itself. Another place in the teachings, and I don't know where this comes from, says the warped mind is always on fire. The warped mind is always on fire. And I can relate to that. Maybe you can too. If you experience anger or frustration, or those places where we get so activated that there is this warp that is in the mind. Like we really literally cannot see clearly. It's like looking through one of those carnival mirrors, it's really wavy and you can't get a clear, steady view. And there's a fire in that. There's the desire for the mind to settle, the discomfort of the warped mind. Although we can get used to it, we can condition the mind to always look in in a certain way that is confused, that does come out of ignorance. So how do we rely on the Dharma, and the Dharma being not only what the Buddha taught, but also the way of things, the nature of things, the truth that life includes suffering, the truth of dukkha, the truth of impermanence, and the very real truth of our interconnection, that everything is connected to every other thing. Nothing is in isolation. So one way that we can support ourselves, and this comes from a story I once heard Joseph Goldstein teach, or to tell about, was he was early in his practice, and he was in India, I believe, practicing, and he was going through a particularly difficult time, and he was feeling that his practice didn't have grounding, felt like it was just all over the place. And he went to his teacher and said, "I can't find my ground in this practice. My practice used to be so much better than it is now." And all of the judging, all of the comparing mind, what do I do? I can't find my ground. And what his teacher said to him is, "Joseph, remember your sila." Sila is the Pali word for our ethical lives, for ethical conduct. And his teacher didn't say it to him as in a punitive way. Remember your sila, as if he had done something wrong and that's why his practice was feeling unsteady. It was actually quite the opposite. Is remember the goodness of your heart. Remember your good intentions. Remember the good you've done. It will support you. And this is important during these times, is to come back to who we are, what we know about ourselves, back to what Zia said about be really present. And also Chris around metta, the Brahmaviharas, to really continually commit to cultivating the friendly heart and to this practice of non-harming. Because when we come back to that and start seeing the ways that that is happening in our lives, it is reinforcing of the good, and it does help the fiery mind to soothe. It cools the mind. Because we know that hatred never ends by hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. And we know this teaching. It's not just from the Buddha, it's from Gandhi, it's from Martin Luther King. We know this, probably many others as well. But when we're caught up in the outrage, in the terror, afraid or angry, it's hard to keep our ground. So to remember who you are, remember your goodness. You know, this invocation in so many teachings, "O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, remember your luminous mind, your good heart. Trust it. It is home." This is a very powerful and beautiful way to help cool the flames of the mind. And it's not easy, right? It's not easy. It sounds like it is, but it's not. And we know that, because if it was easy, we would have had this down a long time ago. We probably wouldn't keep showing up over and over and over again. And I keep showing up over and over and over again, because I need the reinforcement, the surety of the practice. I need to be with all of you, especially when things are so intense. Kobun Chino Roshi, a Zen master from the last century, said, "The more you sense the rareness and value of your own life, the more you realize that how you use it, how you manifest it, is all your responsibility." We face such a big task, so such a person sits down for a while. Isn't that beautiful? The more you sense the rareness and value of your own life, the more you realize how you use it, how you manifest it, is all your responsibility. We face such a big task, so naturally, we sit down for a while. So we'll move into our meditation now. So once again, finding a posture that's really comfortable, yet steady, a posture, whether you're seated, standing, lying down, whatever that posture is, where you can sense into your body and have a sense of wakefulness, uprightness. And what I mean by uprightness is this wakefulness. You may be reclining, you may be horizontal, but there's still an uprightness, a presence of mind. And we come into this practice with a warm heart. Can you approach practice with some friendliness and warmth, any amount that's available to you today? Knowing that you are right here at this time, present in the body. Sensing the places the body is connected to the furniture or the floor. That sense of groundedness. And turning the awareness inward. Listening, allowing whatever to arise, to hang out a little while and to pass by, a deep listening, deep knowing. Sensing into the heart, welcoming the heart, letting the heart become soft, spacious. Returning to the goodness of the heart over and over again. Trusting this practice. Just sticking with it, breath by breath, thought by thought, sensation by sensation. And then resting in the goodness of who you are. Knowing the incredible gift it is to practice at all. Finding now that place to settle your awareness, whether it's the breath, whether it's sensation in the body, or perhaps your metta practice, the repetition of phrases of well-being, whatever it is, choose your meditation object and try to stay with it. Come back when the mind wanders. Be gentle and kind with yourself and begin again. Returning to this heart of goodness over and over again. And we'll sit quietly. noticing any amount of ease, relaxation that's coming about. Let that in. See if you can sense that open receptivity of mind and body and heart. Letting go, letting be of any busyness, the natural distractions, shifting the awareness to the emerging stillness, ease, and peace. If you're noticing any holding in the body, jaw, neck, shoulders, belly, chest, maybe even hands, see what you can soften, any amount. Not arguing with any tightness, just knowing it and inviting it to soften any amount. And then inside of this softening, can you rest? Can you relax? Still keeping the mind attentive and the heart open, this wakefulness. But it's a relaxed wakefulness. Rest there. Drawing the awareness now to the heart center, sensing into the energy of the heart, the back, the front, the sides, above and below, even the diagonals. Sensing into the entire heart center. And if you like, imagine breathing in fresh energy, fresh breath from all directions into the heart, letting this freshness fill the entire heart space. And breathing out into all of the directions, letting the heart soften a little more, become more spacious, a little more capacity. Breathing like this, this heart's breath for a few breaths. This is a poem from Ellen Bass called The Thing Is. The thing is to love life, to love it even when you have no stomach for it and everything you've held dear crumbles like burnt paper in your hands, your throat filled with the silt of it. When grief sits with you, its tropical heat thickening the air, heavy as water, more fit for gills than lungs. When grief weights you down like your own flesh, only more of it, an obesity of grief, you think, how can a body withstand this? Then you hold your life like a face between your palms, a plain face, no charming smile, no violet eyes, and you say, yes, I will take you. I will love you again. To holding yourself with that kindness. With that deep goodness, that essential goodness. To love ourselves again with the quality of no matter whatness. And then bringing to mind anybody who comes to mind and offering them the same wish for their well-being. For them to be able to love their life, to love themselves. This radiating metta practice, letting the goodness of your heart radiate to the goodness of theirs. And see if you can breathe with that for a little bit. So we'll take 5 minutes, take a break, and come back at 11 o'clock or 11:01, according to my clock, and see if during this 5 minutes you can just maintain that ease, that relaxation, that love that comes up. All right, see you in 5 minutes. All right, so toxic stress and trauma, used interchangeably. A really great definition of that is the perception of an event, the perception of an event or events that create the experience of overwhelm. The nervous system is activated in a way that the brain is activated and floods the mind, and we don't have access to our clear thinking. And it's important to to point out that word if it's the perception of event or events that create this overwhelm, because we're all different. So some of us can find, we can all experience the same event, and some of us may experience it as trauma, where we get into overwhelm, and some of us may not. So it's not to say that a perception is true or false. It's just our perception. This is what we experience. And resiliency is the capacity to bounce back after difficulty, to re-regulate the nervous system in response to a difficult experience. And again, we are all completely different about this. It's been shown through research that we come with a certain resiliency. We are wired in our genetics to have a certain amount of resiliency. But this is something that we can strengthen through mindfulness practice, through cultivating stability and clarity. So what does that have to do with the second foundation of mindfulness? The second foundation of mindfulness, or Vedana in the Pali, is often translated as feeling tone, the tone of an experience, how an experience feels, pleasant, neutral, or unpleasant. And feeling tone can be a clunky translation. It is for me when I think about Vedana. Feeling tone is not what I sense. What I sense more is the quality of experience. And so this is just a semantic distinction, and you can find that for yourself. However you would describe pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, the experience of that is Vedana. And what's so interesting and critical about this aspect of mindfulness is that we can categorize any experience that we have somewhere along that continuum line of extremely pleasant to a little pleasant to getting into this neutral zone to a little unpleasant, a little more unpleasant to awful. And this is just how it is. And if you think about all of your experiences, they land somewhere on that continuum, and often we're not aware of it. It can be very pre-verbal, subconscious, and we can test that out. You walk into a room, and on some unconscious level, we are sensing what the energy is in a room before there's even any interaction. But through presence, through our presence of mind, our mindfulness, and we stay with it, we actually can know, oh, pleasant. Oh, good. This is, you know, we can feel the whole body relax. Or any amount of unpleasant, there tends to be a little bit of armoring or preparing or holding. So when we understand, there's this experience of we can understand pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, but experiencing it, really knowing it, is a little different, because we easily understand and experience pleasant, right? I mean, that's nice. It's easy. It's not challenging. And we typically want more of it, of course. But we're less aware of the ways necessarily that it influences our thoughts, our speech, and what we do. And this is an important piece of why Vedana is so critical, why it is the second foundation of mindfulness right after awareness of the body and awareness of the breath, because of how pleasant, neutral, or unpleasant conditions our lives, how it informs our experience. I think it's valuable to know that we don't typically live on the ends of the extremes of pleasant, really pleasant, or really unpleasant. We're much more in the noodle, in the neutral middle. That's the noodle. That was the word that just came out. That place that things are okay. Maybe we're not really paying that much attention because nothing is really grabbing us. And we are in that space quite a lot. But it's through mindfulness, through this awareness, that we can start noticing how the experience, wherever we are in that continuum, leads us in a certain direction. And then the positive part about this, the thing that's so great, is that when we are aware of liking, not liking, comfort, discomfort, pleasant, unpleasant, we can be very conscious about our choices. And oftentimes that whole spectrum of pleasant to unpleasant leads us to the experience of reactivity, of suffering. And so much of our practice is about transforming reactivity into responsiveness. And this is why we really want to be present with our lives, to know how the Vedana is influencing our experience. And oftentimes when we are in reactivity, it leads to rejection. When we're into responsiveness, it takes us much more into acceptance. So we can look at reactivity and responsiveness and acceptance and rejection as completely interwoven, conditioned by the Vedana. Just going to make sure everybody is muted here. There we go. Okay. So how does that work? How does it work? I think that these, the reactions to the pleasant and unpleasant, especially the unpleasant, the challenging, happens lightning fast before we're even aware of it. And this is where our practice comes in. That we can create a space. You know, so often you know what it's like to get triggered by something, maybe angry, and you say something quickly that you wish you hadn't have said, right? That's the classic example of it. And we all know what that's like. So we get reminded from Viktor Frankl, who says, between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space lies our freedom and our power to choose our response. And in our response grows our freedom. And this can be really hard to sense into that space. I mean, that's a very famous quote from him, but because it's true, it's used all the time around how we transform reactivity into responsiveness, how we work with trauma to transform trauma into resiliency, is to beware of the spaces that we actually do have where we can move in that space. So judgment and reactivity are typically what come out of that place of discomfort, not liking, rejection of self, rejection of others. I mean, you know, we don't have to look too far to see the intensity of the reactivity, the rejection of others. So, you know, remembering that to distinguish the word judgment or judgmental from wisdom and discernment, that the way I'm using it here is that it's projecting, when we're using judgment or judgmental, it's projecting conditioned beliefs onto a current experience, regardless of the accuracy or relevance of our present experience. So it's just taking old stuff and projecting it onto what's happening now, with perhaps not even really looking at what's happening now. That's that quick judgmental mind. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha said, do not consider the faults of others or what they have or haven't done. Consider, rather, what you yourself have or haven't done. Do not consider the faults of others or what they have or haven't done. Consider what you yourself have or haven't done. I want to make a distinction about how I relate to this teaching. This isn't, again, about a punitive action. Don't find the faults of others, just look at yourself. It's actually about, of course, we all will have times where we act in ways that we may regret later. But if we focus on what we think are the negative, bad, faulty actions of others, we are doing some projection, but there's also a lack of, like, let's look at ourselves too. Let's not hold ourselves up as the moral authority, but let's actually take stock in what are our own actions. And this comes back to what we said before the meditation about remember your sila, right? Reinforcing all the time a commitment to non-harming, to living an ethical life. And this is what the Buddha taught. This goes to the next step called the bliss of blamelessness. And I like to think of it as radical responsibility, not necessarily the bliss of blamelessness. That is the language of his time. But how do we take radical responsibility from the root? That's what I mean when I say radical. I don't mean extremist. I mean complete responsibility for our lives. So yes, of course, we can look outside of ourselves and we can lay blame and we can find fault. And yet the antidote to that is to continue to cultivate taking responsibility for our lives. So we really use our practice to really understand the practice of non-harming, to really cultivate an ethical life. And bit by bit, we harm ourselves less and harm others less. It just happens bit by bit. And when we blow it, and we do something that is harmful, unintentionally, we course correct. So this is inside that experience of Vedana where these things occur. So reactivity is our response to the judgmental mind, that automatic grasping, clinging, rejecting, pushing away of whatever our experience may be, or acting out of habitual patterns without thinking. I know you know these things because we talk about it regularly in our practice. This is what the practice is about. And it's not so easy, is it? It's just not so easy because we get activated. We get frightened. What's happening in our country is frightening. And so how do we respond out of that? Here's a poem from Nikki Giovanni called Allowables. I killed a spider, not a murderous brown recluse, nor even a black widow. And if the truth were told, this was only a small, papery sort of spider who should have run when I picked up the book, but she didn't, and she scared me, and I smashed her. I don't think I'm allowed to kill something because I'm frightened. This is how our ethical lives get woven in. I don't think I'm allowed to kill something because I'm frightened. Can we have the mindful awareness to pause, right? To watch the impulse? Because we are impulsive if we're not thinking. I think that so much of what has benefited me in my own practice is impulse control. And it's not that I'm inert. I definitely can be impulsive. I can definitely say things that I wish I hadn't have said. But I'm more aware. And this is what our practice does, is to let us know I'm frightened right now. And the fear may be covered over by anger, outrage, all of it. But how do we get back to what's really happening inside of us so we can respond as well as possible? How do we manage this struggle? Why is unpleasant so powerful? This is an important piece. So I want to talk a little bit about what's happening in the brain and some of the neurobiology, a little bit of the nervous system when it comes to Vedana. This is how this is woven together. And part of, I think, the brilliance of the Buddha is that when he really sat down to watch his own mind and own heart and the present moment awareness, when he started to see how the experience of pleasant, neutral, or unpleasant conditioned his thoughts and his actions. He didn't need fancy neurobiological research to prove this. He figured it out by watching himself. And we can too. So why is unpleasant so powerful? So remembering again the definition of trauma or toxic stress, the perception of an event or events that create the experience of overwhelm. The nervous system is activated in a way that blocks our clearest thinking. So you may know this and bear with me. Deep inside the brain is the amygdala. And the amygdala is an almond-shaped structure that is responsible for sensing danger, keeping us on alert. It's where the core of fight, flight, freeze occurs, where there's an event happens, something that we sense the danger, there's some fear, and then the adrenaline starts to pump and the cortisol and the mind gets flooded with these neurotransmitters. And that's what happens in frightening experiences. That's the job of the amygdala. And the amygdala is an ancient structure in the brain that actually functions to keep us safe, to sense danger, but it can be overly active. So we are on high alert all the time. Or maybe it's not very active and it isn't sensing danger, but we all have this. We all also have, which weaves right into the negativity bias of the brain. This is also fundamental to our wiring, which is that we tend to be looking out for the danger. Or we see there's a seductive part of a negative experience, a difficult experience that holds our attention. It gets its Velcro hooks in us in a way that pleasant or positive experiences don't. And we can change this with our practice by paying attention and shifting our awareness. So as a basic example of how this works, if you've ever been in a conversation where maybe it's a work conversation, and you had a job evaluation and you went for the job evaluation and the person giving you the feedback tells you 9 things that are so wonderful about you, that this person appreciates you so much for all of these things you've done. And then she says, and there's just one thing I'd like you to be aware of. What are you going to remember? Right? We immediately go to, oh my God, I screwed that up. And you're going to forget the 9 wonderful things that were just reflected back to you. But that one thing just gets in us. And this is a couple things, I think. One is the negativity bias, for sure, because we are woven. We are wired for that. But the other part of this, this is not our neurobiology. We have in our culture a culture of mastery or perfectionism that we project onto ourselves or wherever it's come from, that we're supposed to know everything. We're supposed to know how to do everything according to some other conditioned conventions about perfection. Perfection doesn't exist except in our minds. And it can undermine us completely when we think we're not measuring up. So we get the work evaluation and we get a 95% on it. Can that be good enough? Can we give ourselves the space to grow? And then maybe if that other 5% of the thing the person said that she'd like us to work on, maybe we don't agree. You know, we don't have to believe everything that other people say. That's the other part. But can we be good enough for ourselves? This is part of our practice. Can we be good enough for ourselves? Can we love ourselves even though? So this negativity bias of the brain is real. And it said, I think that the physicist who coined this phrase was a man named Donald Hebb in 1949, and the phrase is, neurons that fire together wire together. You're likely familiar with that. And it's true. Neurons that fire together wire together. So think about, if you spend your day thinking about everything that's unpleasant, wrong, corrupt, use any word you want for that. What's going to happen is the mind's going to have that. That's what you're going to think about, because we're reinforcing those neural pathways of that negativity bias. But we have a choice. We can shift out of that hardened groove and actually notice what's good. Notice what's right. What else is true? And that's a very good question to use when you feel stuck. If you feel stuck in difficulty, sadness, pain, which all may be true. It's not to say that it isn't real. It is real. But sometimes, you know, when you get the broken record going, to ask yourself, what else is true? You know, what can you look outside in nature and see that is beautiful? Have you seen the murmurations of the starlings around Santa Rosa? It's unbelievable. I haven't been there. I've seen these pictures. But what can you notice outside of yourself that is beautiful? Or can you even notice what is inside of yourself that is beautiful? Take in the good. The Buddha said that which one frequently thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. That's the same thing as neurons that fire together, wire together. Rick Hansen, the great, wonderful neuropsychologist, says that the mind is like Velcro for the negative and Teflon for the positive. You may have heard that. It's true, you can feel it. I can feel it. So this is part of how we learn to shift from traumatic experience to bring the nervous system back into balance when we have this information and actually start to understand the relationship to unpleasant, to the reactivity, to what is happening in the nervous system, and how we can intentionally, through our awareness, what we pay attention to, we can start to shift that. And it doesn't in any way mean that the difficulty isn't true. It's just that we have a choice what we pay attention to. That's really the salient point here. So I want to show you an example of what's happening in the brain. And I am not a neuroscientist, but this is kind of a fun way to conceptualize what is going on when we get activated. Anybody familiar with Dan Siegel's hand model of the brain? Anybody know it? I can't see everybody, so I'm just going to tell you about this. So you can see my arm, right? If you're looking. Okay, so here's how it goes. Here's the spinal column. This is what my forearm represents here. And then coming into the wrist area, the spinal cord comes up into the wrist and into the brainstem. So in this model, the brainstem, my palm is representing the brainstem, the deepest, oldest part of the brain. It takes in information from the body, and it's also the place of the autonomic nervous system. The involuntary systems in the body are regulated by the brainstem, like digestion, circulation, breathing, respiration, these things that we don't have control over. So here's the brainstem. And then the thumb here, this is the limbic system. And the limbic system is where the amygdala is, where we experience the emotional life. That's that source of meaning and arousal and fight, flight, freeze. That's happening in the limbic system. And then fingers over the top like this. You see the brain now? This is how this works. Here's the cortex. That regulates the other parts of the brain, the thinking, the thoughts, mapping of experiencing, of experience, knowing what's what. And this fingernail area, this is the prefrontal cortex. And that's where our higher thinking happens, the executive function, our ability to really sequence and take in our experience and make a decision about what to do. The executive function is what is functioning when we see a stop sign ahead, and then we have all these different things while we're driving that we need to do in order to stop at that stop sign. That comes from the executive function and that decision making. It's an integration of experience. So when we're frightened, when arousal happens or activated and there's this fear response, there's increased activity happening in the limbic system, and it starts to get very agitated and activated. And then here's what happens. Boom. We flip our lid. And in the flipping of the lid, that's how Dan describes this, we're no longer making integrated connections with the different parts of the brain. And we go into this place of activation. We don't have the smooth connections. And this is where we feel the overwhelm, where the neurotransmitters are flooding the brain. And because these different parts of the brain are less integrated with each other, we have less access to our clear thinking. Back to Vedana, right? When something is intensely pleasant, it can even happen, or intensely unpleasant when we're frightened. So Dan goes on to say that the best indicator of our well-being is the degree to which these various aspects of the brain are connected and working together, are integrated. So when we see that model of the brain, I hope what that, I know it's extremely rudimentary, but it gets the point across. You can see that we have some capacity to shift our thoughts, to come back over and over again, which helps ease the amygdala, which helps let the amygdala know it doesn't have to be on high alert. We're actually okay. And so then our task as we come back to a more balanced place is that we start to cultivate our wisdom, this non-judgmental discernment, awareness based on our present moment, direct experience. And that requires curiosity, openness, willingness, the willingness to see, to pause, to listen, to not take things personally, to have a broader perspective, to be able to ask ourselves questions like, what's really happening here? To really stay present. And that tells the amygdala, the danger sensor, to not worry. It's like telling ourselves, we got this, I'm okay. You don't need to be pumping out right now. Take a break. We're all right. In fact, Rick Hansen says, we are almost always basically all right. We are almost always basically all right. And that is a really important thing to remember when you are frightened, when something is really up, to check around, to really pause and see if you can feel the groundedness of the body, feet on the floor, butt in the chair, feel the breath coming and going, roof over your head. Really checking in with those basics can help bring that reactivity down. And that's when the responsiveness can start to emerge. The skillful actions based on our direct experience that stems from this wisdom, from the present moment, and ultimately the clarity, the balance, which then transforms to compassion, to love, to understanding. So again, resiliency is this capacity to bounce back after a difficult experience. And one more thing about this that I think is valuable to know is we all have what is known as a resiliency zone. Some people talk about it as a window of tolerance. That's actually Dan Siegel's language. I like resiliency zone a little bit better. And how to think about this is, imagine two parallel lines, and maybe they're really close together. Maybe they're just a little bit further apart, or maybe they're really, really wide. And this is the zone in which we feel, in which we function most of the time. And we all know that we have these normal ups and downs that happen throughout the day. And sometimes we get a little bit, what's called upregulated, or sometimes downregulated. You know, we're just a little activated, maybe a little low, but we go in between this place. And this is normal. This is just what we do in response to our lives. But when we get activated, frightened, agitated, we can get bumped up above this top line. And that's the fight flight. And when we start to know it, then we can have practices that help bring us back down. Or maybe we get bumped below that down-regulated, where we get depression, numbness, where we can't really function. And again, the more we know about this, we actually understand what's happening. And then we can start to bring in some skills and tools to help re-regulate the nervous system, like meditation, like mindfulness, the mindfulness of the body, feeling the groundedness of the body, sensing, literally tracking sensation in the body. You might notice pain, discomfort that moves, changes, just how the body is. And then this practice of noticing what's good, bringing to mind anything, person, place, thing, whatever it is that brings you some solace. Back to that question in the beginning of our time together. What keeps you afloat? What are some of those experiences that really support your well-being? That becomes a resource. And you can bring that to mind and even describe it to yourself. Actually, let's just do that for a moment. Just go inside. If you'd like to close your eyes, close your eyes. Sense the furniture beneath you, right where you are, whether you're sitting or standing. Maybe you're standing. Take a breath or two. Noticing any predominant sensations, pleasant, comfortable, neutral, uncomfortable, unpleasant. Just noticing, but shifting intentionally to a place in the body that is comfortable, wherever that is. We'll just stay there for a little bit. I notice my hands are relaxed. And now bringing to mind something that really supports you. Maybe it's a beautiful experience or a person. Anything that lifts your heart, brings you some happiness, some joy, and contentment. Perhaps it's a favorite place in nature or a favorite book. Just bring that to mind and describe it to yourself. If there are predominant colors, characteristics, whatever this is, tastes or smells, touch. Inviting yourself to remember the pleasantness of this. Okay, and come back. So what we did with that short exercise is a very effective way to shift from an activated nervous system to re-regulate. We started with grounding, sensing the body right where you are. And then we went into tracking, noticing sensation. And then what's called resourcing, bringing to mind something that really supports you. And these are three pretty much tried and true skills that can help to re-regulate and bring us back into balance. I want to end with a poem from Teddy Macker. This is called "The Mosquito Among the Raindrops." "This mosquito among the raindrops, it's equivalent to getting hit," says the scientist, "by a falling school bus, and hit every 20 seconds, and the mosquito lives. In fact, she doesn't even try to avoid the drops. No zigzagging, no ducking, no hiding under eaves. How does she do it? No resistance to the force. She hitches a ride on the blow, a stowaway on that which brings her down. She becomes one with the drop, knowing that to fly again, she must fall." I love that poem. It's like getting hit by a school bus every 20 seconds. So this is why Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, has a critical role in our experience of trauma and resiliency or toxic stress. And we can use these skills as we navigate our lives and in our view of what's happening in our country. We can stabilize ourselves through these skills.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.